This is AOS Capus. This is stormy weather. This is news from the front line in the end times. Once again, I'll be answering questions from listeners this week. There's quite a few questions that have gathered at the blog. I'm very glad to report. For those of you who don't already know, the blog is aoscaphus.blogspot.com. Last week I edited the show down and I cut out all the pauses in my diatribe, and as a result of that I realized that it was so incredibly fast moving that even I had a hard time keeping up with what I was talking about. So I'm not going to do that this week. I'm going to allow the pauses, at least some of them, to remain, and so that you can experience my thought processes as they are occurring, and if that means dead air on the podcast, well, so be it. These podcasts are a process of exploration for me as much as for my listeners, and probably a lot more so. I am simply trying to figure out, like everyone else, how to navigate an increasingly confusing world in which we are inundated with information, with facts, with factoids, with points of views, with theories, with beliefs, and have no possible chance to assimilate. We're just looking for ideas that we can actually use. So it's a never-ending process, and this is the process which I am now caught up in, and I really don't know what to make of any of this. The more that one knows, the more information one gathers, the harder it is to really decide anything or to really have an opinion about anything at all. So everything that we're talking about here, inevitably, as long as we're using language, is a way of talking around the subject, the true subject, which is ourselves, which is our knowing. And we're looking for ways to extend that knowing and ways to communicate it. And so, now that I've qualified everything that's about to come, and essentially my reason for that little spiel was that I'm becoming quite painfully aware on these podcasts of how little I do know, and of how difficult it is for me to hold on to a point of view or an opinion, or indeed to know exactly what I'm going to say until after I've said it. I'm trying to discover new stuff here, not simply communicate things that I've already worked out. And so I will try and answer all your questions, but I can't simply answer your questions with my opinions or what it is that I've already discovered about these things, at least not exclusively. I'm also going to be using your questions as ways to go deeper into these subjects than I've been before. And I see it as a kind of ball game in which you're knocking these balls my way and I'm doing my best to knock them back to you, and so we can keep up this give and take. I have some questions here from Eunice, which I'm going to start with. As the end times are here, just wonder, are relevant dreams possible visions of what is to come? Other dreams feel like an experience preparing. Can we be prepared?
Dreaming. Where do we go when we dream? Are we the same when we come back? We spend a third of our lives asleep and dreaming, and yet we only retain a small fraction of those experiences. Many of us, perhaps most of us, have experienced how time is unimaginably condensed in dreaming, or rather how consciousness seems to be accessing experiences at a different frequency, so that we can fall asleep for 10 seconds and during that 10 second period have an enormous dream experience, a very complex narrative, which any number of events come to pass that in our normal waking consciousness would take perhaps hours. So that suggests that every night, let's say that we spend 5 hours a night in REM sleeping, in this accelerated state of consciousness, and these dreams are like blocks of intensity in which as I say, time is running on a different frequency, and so it's possible that in 5 hours of sleep every night, we are having the equivalent of several days or even several weeks worth of experience. So if we calculate from that very loose estimation throughout the years, we are amassing potentially hundreds of years of experience in this dream state. And since all memories are stored in the body and are accessible through hypnosis, for example, or through other methods, stored in the DNA, then all of this experience, and it is experience because it's the only criteria for experience is consciousness. Why do we not remember our dreams? Well, because they're taking place at a different frequency. Our consciousness is tuned in at a different wavelength. And so when we return to this wavelength, we don't have access to those memories, just as we don't have access to our childhood memories, because we're in such a completely different state of consciousness when we're small children, that the only way to access those memories would be to also access the state of consciousness in which we were functioning as children, as small children. And that is monumentally difficult. It's a movement of the assemblage point from one position to the other, as opposed to a very minor shift which we will experience on a day-to-day level with our moods or with illness, or even the things we put in our body will shift our assemblage point in a very minor way, and how we experience ourselves as different people even throughout the day according to our moods, how our perceptions change, how somebody can look beautiful 1 minute and ugly the next according to the way we feel about them. All of this relates to very minor movements of the assemblage point. But a major shift is essentially, it's like entering into another self. And so these selves that we inhabit, that are aspects of our totality as consciousness, are compartmentalized. They're kept separate from each other in the positions of the assemblage point. So dreams. There are definitely various kinds of dreams, and some are more real than others. There are dreams that are simply anxiety dreams, the brain working off residual anxieties of the day. They could also be fantasy wish fulfillment dreams. These are very superficial kind. A deeper level of dreaming would be the symbolic kind, in which our unconsciousness is giving us encoded messages through the symbolism of the dream, and these are still very personal, and they would still be less than real experiences in the sense that we are creating a narrative in order to communicate something to our conscious minds. These dreams can be very profound and very useful, but they don't constitute actual experience in the left side. They're still experience, because anything, as I've said, that consciousness interacts with, anything that is a product of consciousness is also an experience for consciousness, a way for it to understand itself. A daydream is an experience, but they're not experience in the sense of having an objective reality, that our consciousness is interacting with an objective reality outside of the creations of our own mind. The third level of dreaming would be when we enter fully into the left side and we interact with other individuals or other dimensions that do have objective existence. And this would be lucid dreaming, astral projection, or simply left side dreams, a second attention, in which we are essentially, we are operating in another self, as another self. It's a secret self, it's a secret life that all of us have. And these dreams are remarkable in how real they are. They may not be lucid in the sense that we know that we're dreaming at the time, or they may be. It may be that we don't know that we're dreaming because, in a sense, we're not dreaming. we're in another body, in another world, or another aspect of this world, interacting with people that we may or may not know in this world, in their other selves. And I think that we're all doing this, but some more than others. And perhaps not all even, but many of us are doing this, and then a very small number of people are becoming aware of it and actually entering consciously into these other realms, into these other selves, in order to forge connections with other beings, other sorcerers. This is the second intention. So this is certainly a way to prepare, because we're storing these memories and these experiences, so it's essentially we're in training. Our dream life is a form of training. And the challenge of the sorcerer is to integrate the two selves and to move the assemblage point to other positions in order to claim the memory of these experiences in the dream realm, in the second attention, and so claim the power of these experiences. We are greatly more than we normally imagine ourselves to be in our waking lives. And eventually, potentially, we are the sum of all these experiences, not just of everything we've lived in this life, every thought we've had and every word that we've spoken, but of every dream experience also, which, as I say, if it was flattened out into linear time, would be hundreds and hundreds of years, if not thousands of years of experience. And that is simply our individual selves, our bipolar selves. Next question: is death of ego what is required to create consciousness, or is the eventual awakening what will bring about the end of it, the end of the ego? Well, that's a chicken or the egg sort of question, isn't it? The ego doesn't have to die as such, but it does have to transform, and the transformation is a death of the personal self. But again, if we use our model of the assemblage point, the energetic organ of awareness through which we perceive reality in ourselves, so it's more or less synonymous with the ego. A movement of the assemblage point from one position to another, and a real movement, would entail a form of ego death, but the ego wouldn't be dying, it would simply be transforming into a whole new self. Because when we move the assemblage point, we experience another reality, so we experience ourselves as other also. So the process is a form of death, but it's no more death of the ego than the birth of a butterfly is death of the caterpillar. It's simply the next state. There is a difference between the lunar, or the personal self, and the solar, or the impersonal self. And the one is a bridge to the other. And the lunar self is a temporary thing. It doesn't have any light or existence of its own, any more than the moon has its own light. But it does reflect to us the impersonal self, the solar self. And so it serves its purpose, which is to guide us through the dark night of the soul, when the light of the true self can't reach us. So to try and bring about ego death prematurely would be a mistake. Or to try and bring about ego death at all is a mistake, because it's not something that we can bring about. That would simply be suicidal for the ego to try and bring about its own death. And after all, as long as we're trying to do something, having opinions or thoughts about anything, then we're in the place of the ego, not in the place of awareness. That takes care of itself. The awakening of the solar self is simultaneous with the shedding of the skin of the lunar self. But that is not to say that we have to try and shed our personal selves in order to enter into our impersonal solar selves. It's not a cause and effect process in that way. Extraterrestrial invasion is inevitable, and though it is physically possible, it seems there would be too much trauma for some. Agreed. Could this also be interpreted as actually an invasion or a raise of vibration? I think it can be interpreted either way, or indeed both ways. And I think it will be both, depending on our own vibration and our own ability to change vibrations or move the assemblage point from the personal to the impersonal. So the personal self, which is identified with the body, with the physical, and with the mind, the influx of impersonal archetypal energy that an extraterrestrial invasion would be one aspect of, let's say, is going to be experienced as traumatic. We would experience it in negative terms because we would experience this archetypal energy as everything that we are not, as the other. And as such, we will unconsciously, inevitably project onto this force everything that we've disowned, which is to say our shadow self, all the parts of ourselves that we can't deal with, that we don't want to deal with, that we're trying to separate from ourselves so that we can push them away, not take responsibility for them, and create a fragmented self which is comfortable, which fits with our very limited personal idea of what we want from life and what we want ourselves to be. And this is simply not possible. Inevitably, all those disowned aspects find ways to come back to us and confront us in our everyday circumstances and the people that we meet, and bodily disorders, disease, mental disorders, diseases, you name it. So an extraterrestrial invasion, you might say, is the ultimate manifestation of the other. And so it's going to be like a magnet for all these aspects, fragments of ourselves, of our totality, that we've disowned. They're going to be drawn into the vortex that this influx of energy is creating. And that is what we will experience before we can even begin to connect to or surrender to the archetypal energy that is flooding the earth at this time. For example, Christians will experience extraterrestrial invasion as demonic. Others may experience them as vampires, as succubi. We're all creating this vision of the greys, which is becoming more or less consolidated in our awareness, whether or not we believe in them or not, just in the same way that whether or not we're practicing Christians, we are still products of a culture which is built around Christian ideology, imagery and symbolism and mythology. And so our very language and our way of thinking is informed by these ideas. And so the UFO extraterrestrial meme, which has only been around for about 60 years, is having the same effect upon us. It is actually shaping our perceptions. Whether or not we adhere to it, believe in it, subscribe to it, doesn't really matter. Because as long as we are allowing our environment and our personal relationship to the environment and to these ideas and to these forces to shape our experience of them, then we are essentially hooked into the consensus reality, and that has a momentum of its own. It's almost impossible to break out of the consensus. It's like swimming against the current. It's just has so much pull that it is almost irresistible to simply go along with it. And simply swimming against the current doesn't necessarily work anyway, because the current is stronger than we are. Chances are we'll just go under. The only way to break from consensus is to move the assemblage point, to enter into another self, to let go of our identity. And as I've said, that's not something we can do by willing it to happen. So it's a process of deconstruction, of observation, and of taking responsibility for these aspects of ourselves. And this is a very long-winded answer to a fairly simple question. I think that the extraterrestrial invasion, which I also agree is inevitable, whether or not it's experienced as an invasion, indeed whether it's authentic or not, because there may be a fabricated alien invasion round the next corner, which has nothing to do with archetypal energies, really, which is all too human and all too personal agendas, imitating a much subtler event. But in any case, in a sense, that's another manifestation of what I'm talking about. The archetypal energy is also moving these human agencies to create an imitation of itself as their way to protect themselves from it. And in a sense, that's its only option to protect itself from the true event, is to buy into the false simulation of it. Not that it will work, but it will be a temporary stopgap. Okay, I'm going to have to move on because there's a lot of questions here. Do you think we are returning to a hive mind kind of consciousness? And if so, what would such a state of consciousness be like? It is possible to remember memories that do not belong to the personal self. It's possible to remember other people's dreams. It's possible to remember so-called past lives. It's possible to see things through another person's eyes. Empathy is to experience another's suffering or their joy as one's own. But at that point, one's sense of self is no longer fixed, it's become fluid. The assemblage point is moving, it's in motion. And this would be the first taste that we have of a hive mind, of a collective consciousness, as opposed to a collective unconscious, which already exists. If we were able to remember other people's experiences, other lives, and if our consciousness, that until now has been synonymous with our personal self, our self-reflective identity, if it were to be gradually or rapidly flooded with memories and perceptions belonging, as it were, to other individuals, then it'd be easy to imagine how our personal self would become less and less real to us in that smorgasbord of perceptions, of memories, of feelings, of realities. We might still have it as a point of reference, but it would no longer be the only point of reference. And the more we open to these other experiences, including our own experiences in the left side of dreaming, visions, our future selves, our past lives, the less we would be able to cling to individual identity. And yet, it can easily be seen how our personal self wouldn't be becoming less. Our consciousness wouldn't be being reduced by this. There would be no death or destruction involved. There would simply be a steady expansion of consciousness. And this would be the ego. All of this would be the ego, because it would be our perception. And the ego is simply an organ of perception, just as the sun is an ego. The eye is a form of ego, you might say. Our ego self resides in our eyes, which is why we think of ourselves as being behind our eyes. Because perception, the point of view, is synonymous with ego. Stars are egos. They're points of view. But the entire universe is also an ego, is also an organ of perception. And so this is the point that we're at as a species. We're moving very, very rapidly now from individual consciousness to a different sort of consciousness which pertains to the Earth and to the solar system and to the entire cosmos. It's a series of leaps that we'll be making within the next 100 years or so, by which we will, as a species, move from localized awareness to non-local awareness. And this will be the hive mind. You see, the Earth is an organism that is conscious, but it is not self-conscious. as such. It is only self-conscious through humanity, and humanity is not conscious of its connection to the earth, which is how it's able to destroy the earth. And essentially, since humanity is the mind of the earth, earth is destroying itself through us. This is simply a process. The earth is awakening, and it's doing so through a kind of pressure, a self-imposed pressure. It's a crisis. It's a crisis that is being created by all of us in order to bring ourselves around to the truth. And it feels like the end, when in fact it's the beginning. So this kind of consciousness of which I speak is the consciousness of an intelligent system. The earth is a living organism which, in order to become self-conscious or self-aware, needs to light up all the neurons, the byways and the highways of that circuit board of the earth, which is to say humanity, because humanity is the missing link in that circuit board. It's the weak link, it's the faulty connection. All the other animals, creatures on the earth are aware, but they can't be self-aware, because that is something that only humanity has the capacity for. And this capacity, which is, of course, comes hand in hand with an awareness of our death, has created in us a kind of despair that has driven us into this suicidal frenzy into which we are now locked as a species. But this is simply a necessary danger of the process. And it is a danger. There is always a risk that the earth will destroy itself through our activities. But you don't make an omelette without breaking any eggs. It's simply the nature of the alchemy. There's always an element of risk there. But potentially the earth, by becoming self-aware, will become a link in the cosmic chain of the solar system. So it will become aware of itself then, and we as a species will become aware of ourselves as a cell in the body of the cosmos. And so, as a cell in the body, we are one with the body. So at that point, individual consciousness no longer exists, unless we talk about consciousness of the universe, which is also an individual. Any more than cells have individual consciousness, save through the consciousness of the body. Each cell is conscious, and it is conscious as an individual, but it is not conscious of itself as separate from the body, because it is not separate from the body. So it is impossible for a cell to be conscious of itself separate from the body, except by isolating itself within the body, which is to say, turning against the body, becoming a cancerous cell, eating itself. So the process of becoming self-aware is a process of death, of suicide, of isolation. I don't even know if I can continue this train of thought, to be honest. It's very tricky. It may be that the human species is going through a similar process that a body goes through when it develops cancer and then manages to heal that cancer, or is transformed by that cancer. But then we don't really have precedents for that. We have miraculous healings, but do we have cases in which the body is able to become something else through surviving cancer? I don't know. But as a species, we're definitely becoming something else. We're having to transform at a genetic level, to mutate in order to open to this consciousness, the galactic consciousness. Or it may be the other way around, that the galactic consciousness is coming through us one way or another, and that it's causing a mutation process within us, and that the more that we resist that, the deadlier it becomes, the more this mutation manifests simply as disease. But in order to tune into the collective consciousness, to create it, I might say, the first step is to go inward, into the body, and become aware of the body as a collective of cells. There is a hive consciousness to the body, and we are that hive consciousness. Who we think of as ourselves is simply a surface. It's a construct that's been superimposed on that greater consciousness of the body, that greater intelligence, the body, which is a self-sustaining system of awareness, a hive consciousness in which every cell and every molecule and every atom is connected to every other and yet exists as an individual. And so there is communication between these particles, these individuals. But they cannot seek autonomous existence outside of the collective, because to do so is simply to isolate themselves and to destroy themselves, or potentially to create a chain reaction in which the entire system is destroyed. So if we can tune in, our sicknesses and our diseases are, as Jung said, our way back to the gods, and we are being obliged now to tune into our physical being by all of this discomfort, in order that we may begin to experience our bodies as they are, as a living intelligence of collective beings. The organs, the cells, the molecules, the atoms, all living beings, just as the earth is a living being. Our arrogance as humans is that anything that doesn't have a self-reflective awareness, that doesn't have intellect, is not alive, is not conscious. It may be true, it appears to be true, that we're the only creatures who have developed intellect. And the intellect is a very tricky servant, because it will do everything it can to undermine the collective intelligence which it's serving, and assume the throne of master, because it is given so much power. It is the power of interpretation, the intellect. It analyzes, it rationalizes, it says what's what and what isn't what. And so the intellect has very cleverly told our totality that it is who we are. It's tricked us. And this is a temporary state of affairs. This is what Steiner refers to as Ahriman, the consciousness of our death, bodily identification, and the realm of death is the realm of the intellect. But it's necessary to create a bridge. And the bridge I'm referring to is our physical being, the bridge between the earth and the sun. And this collective consciousness of our bodies is the first stage of a hive mind, is realizing that we are not only part of a hive mind, we are, as individuals, a hive mind, a collective consciousness of cells. That is who we are. Next question. Perhaps you could examine the Blossom Good Child the aliens will appear on October 14th fiasco. Why people believe, why channelers think they are channeling, etc. Blossom released an apology and doesn't seem to have any idea why they didn't show. I was also aware of this prophecy. I didn't take it seriously. There's been so many. I don't expect that, even if there is a fake alien invasion, that it will be announced in advance. Surprise is a key element. I would say that the most likely agenda behind the Blossom Good Child fiasco was as a psyops, like Orson Welles' War of the Worlds hoax, on a much smaller scale, just to gauge people's beliefs, people's reactions. Just one more in a very long line of experiments using belief in extraterrestrial visitation, the arrival of the mothership, etc., to gauge how people are going to react when it finally does occur. That simple, right? Whether or not the Blossom Good Child, etc., were aware of being part of an intelligence operation, I have no idea. I tend to think that these psyops work better when the public agents participating in them actually don't know that they're part of a disinformation system. I would think this is the case with David Icke, possibly even with Alex Jones. They're not really aware of the fact that they're playing into the hands of the very people that they claim to be exposing, and that they're probably doing much more harm than good. Although that's a very subjective point of view, and it's not really, as I've said, about whether something's good or bad, but merely what's the intent behind it. you see, and intent is not intention. Alex Jones or Ikey, they may have all the best intentions in the world, but that's only because they're not conscious of the intent behind what they're doing, which isn't their own. It's a hidden intent, a hidden agenda, I think. I'm not saying that that's the way it is. I'm just saying those are my personal feelings about it. Okay, Vicky said, here's the thing. Presumably your Masonic Sorcery Theatre is the influencing elite's device for hijacking our collective mythic narrative. It works because the part of our brains that perceives the world animistically is still functioning. It's just that our dominant rational minds aren't aware of it. Okay. So how can we tell the difference between a manufactured mythic narrative and the real thing? Take the current financial crisis. Is it theatre or indicative of a shift in our collective consciousness? Could it be both? The difference between a manufactured mythic narrative and the real thing is, as I've just outlined, the difference between conscious intention and unconscious intent, or indeed conscious intent, because there are sorcerers who are an artist, who are creating mythic narratives with a conscious intent to communicate archetypal truths, and they're successful at doing it. This is fairly unusual, I think. Sorcerers who are aligned with intent would not perform theatre on a mass scale. They would do it with their apprentices, with their small group. And artists who are tuning into archetypal energies and have a pure intent are not successful in today's world. That's pretty much guaranteed. So I think that any mythic narratives that we're aware of collectively are going to be manufactured. If we look at the movie The Matrix, for example, that's clearly a manufactured mythic narrative. There is an intent behind it that is profound and archetypal. And so the movie did serve to awaken a lot of people, or at least alert them to something. But there's also a manufactured narrative overlaid on top of that deeper mythic narrative, which is contaminated and which became very obvious with the sequels. So something like The Matrix is clearly part of a psyops, just as flooding the American culture with LSD, creating all of these different countercultural bands, The Doors, The Beatles, Shakespeare himself may have been a psyops. It's very difficult to say, but it would seem to be that just about anything that has a global influence, global impact, has at least been compromised by the Masonic sorcery operatives. They have their fingers in everything. They're very thorough. Somebody like Edgar Allan Poe, who was probably assassinated, is one of several many examples of people who get a little bit too close to creating a true mythic narrative, and who can't be manipulated, who can't be controlled, and whose ideas can't be used to inform the manufactured mythic narrative. I'm getting slightly off the subject now anyway. How can we tell the difference? Well, the source is the main thing, but then how can we determine the source? For example, Hurricane Katrina, was that an act of God, or was that an act of Masonic sorcerers using weather control technology? Or both. Everything is an act of God, of course. Everything is part of the true mythic narrative. It's just that there are levels and layers of artifice, like crust forming around the deeper core, the abstract core of the mythic narrative. The financial crisis is clearly manufactured, but it's also indicative of a shift in our collective consciousness. Everything is reflecting back at us our inner state. It's just a question of how conscious are we of this process, how consciously are we collaborating with the mythic narrative. It's not just what the universe can do for us, it's what we can do for the universe. And as long as we remain passive witnesses, we're like audience in a theater, we're simply sitting back and watching the show. And a show, by definition, is artifice. Unless we actually get up out of our seats and go outside the theatre and start interacting with reality, then we're not part of a true mythic narrative. We're still going to the manufactured mythic narrative. We're interacting with the mythic, the manufactured mythic narrative, as a surrogate for the real thing. So it's like we're in quarantine, we're in self-imposed quarantine as consciousness. We're not ready to deal with reality. We're not ready to deal, to enter into a true mythic narrative and assume our roles within that as solar beings. We're in the lunar position of audience members who are simply being shaped and manipulated and entertained by a manufactured mythic narrative. So the financial crisis, this is an opportunity for those of us who it's affecting, which would probably be everyone eventually, to begin to understand that the crisis is manufactured, because the very thing that is apparently in jeopardy, the economy, is a false construct to begin with. It has no more reality than we have given to it. So we've allowed ourselves to believe in a manufactured mythic narrative, and now that manufactured narrative is actually reaching its climax. It's bringing about its own ruin, because that's part of the narrative. And so the challenge is, do we use this crisis to realize that the whole narrative was manufactured, that the whole edifice of the economy, of money, of capitalism, of communism, of votes and democracy and politics, everything, you know, our whole way of life, all of that is a manufactured mythic narrative. And so we can either cling to that narrative, cling to our belief in it, and go down with it, or we can use this as an opportunity to realize, by looking more closely at what's happening, that all of this has been manufactured, and that the whole economy was created in such a way that it would collapse, in such a way that it would have such an effect, to be used as a means to bring about another mythic narrative, or the next phase of the mythic narrative, which is what we will be entering into in the next 20 years or so, which is the so-called interdependence, where we will become servants of the state, where we will have no freedom of choice whatsoever about who we breed with, about what children we have, about where we work, our forms of transport, our use of money. All of these things may well be under control, I mean a much more totalitarian control, within the next 20 years. The combination of the financial crisis with the environmental crisis, also manufactured, with the population crisis. All of these manufactured crises appear to be being used in order to lock us deeper into the mythic narrative, so that we will surrender completely to it. And it's pre-written, it's pre-designed. Just as 9/11 happened as a means to bring about new laws, new systems, new paradigms, so the financial crisis and the environmental crisis are being manufactured on a much longer term basis to bring about a new system, a new order. But all of this is facilitating a shift in consciousness for the individual, if we know how to use it, if we're able to step outside the manufactured mythic narrative and see the greater narrative that's behind it. Next question. I'm very interested in hearing you talk about Kundalini energy, Homo sapiens DNA, the serpent. What do you know about reptilian aliens? Floyd Anderson question. I'd be interested in talking about that too, Floyd, but I think I'll have to say that, because it's a very complex question, and I can spend hours answering very simple questions, so I think I'd never get out of this chair if I began to answer this one. So later. Can Aeolus explain connection between alien abduction and DMT? Why are these things similar? Why do aliens often look like elves or clowns? Why locations people transported always same? Laboratories and playrooms. Why do aliens want you to nurse babies? And if alien abduction a form of self-help theatre, what are abductees supposed to be learning? Well, That seems to be an area for a whole show. And since I happen to know who this particular anonymous is, I think I'll save these questions for later and possibly discuss them with the source itself. John's question: from your point of view, Michael Hoffman's book, and he quotes my review of Hoffman, saying that how Hoffman admits that by revealing the schemes of the Dark Cabal, he may be unwittingly serving its ends, then he goes ahead and does it anyway. John is interested in this revelation of the method idea, that the more secrets conspiracy researchers bring to light, the more they serve the agenda. This is certainly a tricky area. And I touched upon it earlier when I talked about Alex Jones, David Icke, and the possibility that they may be actually serving the ends of the very agents and agencies that they appear to be attempting to expose. And I also said that this may be unconscious on their part. I think that the key is relates to the way in which the information is communicated. It's not so much, because disinformation is a very subtle thing. To be effective, disinformation is 90% truth and 10% lies. But I would say that disinformation could even be a greater proportion of truth in there. It could even be close to 100% truth, or at least possible truth, one version of the truth. But that the tone in which that truth is conveyed, the spirit and the mood, is crucial. Because this tone will determine the way in which we receive this information, the part of our psyches that is being reached, and also the context in which information is placed, and the context within which Icke and Alex Jones and so many conspiracy researchers put their revelations is a very basic, very all too human context of right and wrong. And they are hell-bent on exposing these schemes, alerting the public to this dastardly plot, and in a sense putting the burden of action on that public, on their audience. They're challenging us to take this truth, to take it on board, and then do something about it. But they're not giving us any tools for what to do with this information and how to do it. The thing about revelation of the method is that the Masonic sorcerers wish to reveal their designs to us in such a way that we will feel helpless, overwhelmed, confused, disorientated, disempowered. They will give us enough understanding of what they're doing to become aware of the vastness and the complexity of it and the brilliance of it, but not enough to really reach a personal understanding of it in terms of our own development as individuals and how we can use this knowledge. You see, knowledge is power, but only if we can actually claim that knowledge. If it's simply spoon-fed to us, handed down to us, or ranted at us from the stage or from internet radio, podcasts, or wherever, we're not going to feel empowered by that knowledge. We're going to feel imposed upon. Paranoid awareness is a means to turn everything that is happening around us, that's conspiring against us, into a means of our empowerment and self-knowledge. And so, revelation of the method is essentially, I believe, the way in which these powers are obliged to play fair. They actually have no choice, because like everything in the universe, they are compelled to adhere to divine law. And even though in their actions and their schemes they are doing everything they can to usurp the divine law and to take this law into their own hands, they can't override their own programming, their divine programming. A sorcery theater is a beautiful thing, because it gives those of us who are willing to open all the way to the truth an opportunity to see the inner workings of the old seers, of these dark Masonic minds. We admire artists, writers, poets, musicians, for creating simple artifacts. And yet what we're observing here with the mapping of the conspiracy, the Masonic sorcery theater, networks of intelligence working together to actually create realities. These agencies create history itself. This is the level of genius at which these individuals are operating. And so simply to dismiss it as dastardly and malevolent, we're judging the end when the end hasn't come. We don't actually know what the end of all these schemes are. So essentially, every system that is used to control us, if it's understood properly, can be used to empower and emancipate us as individuals. The very system that these groups are using to enslave the masses is providing an opportunity for the individual to access his or her own potential as a sorcerer, as a fully activated solar being. This is why it's so essential that we understand the designs of these elite, to see that these controlling elite are only able to do what they're doing because we have left the throne vacant. But the throne is real. The power base which they are using to enslave us is a real power base, and it's alerting us to our own sovereignty, our own potential as sorcerers to create our own realities. This isn't a matter simply of moral outrage. On the contrary, if we are truly open and impartial, we have to admire these groups and individuals, despite the fact that we know that they're psychopaths. And their goal is to create a surrogate reality in which they will be exempt from divine law. And to do that, they need us as raw fuel. But they will not succeed because there is no corner of the universe that can be isolated from the divine, not even with the technology at their disposal. But this is something they have forgotten. They have become blinded to. And so for all their vision and all their worship of the all-seeing eye, these controllers are blind to the one thing that will undo them. As a last-minute question at the blog, I'm not even sure if this is a question, as I haven't got to the end of it yet. A very philosophical addition, anyway, to the blog, from, once again, Anonymous, one more Anonymous. As long as we're on the subject, those of you who prefer to post comments as Anonymous, it may be because you actually want to be Anonymous, but it may also be simply because that's the easiest way to post comments at the blog. So I'd appreciate any of you who don't mind not being anonymous just to sign your comments with a name or some sort of moniker so that I can actually tell the difference between the various anonymouses, because otherwise it's very tantalizing not to know exactly how many people are contributing and who's who. I realize, of course, that that's an intrinsic part to the whole anonymous hive mind community, growing psychic indigo autist movement that the internet is the vessel for, so I don't want to be a drag on that, but I just thought I'd say that. So, anonymous number we don't know what said, "If a tree could bear witness to its own growth and decay and dissolution, it would be doing everything but enjoying the scenery. The universe itself is an assemblage point. Everything pondered, assembled, concluded is a personal story of an individual struggle to survive dissolution, to survive birth. Parcels cannot open themselves. There is nothing to be opened into because the universe itself is the parcel. What animates all and continues to infuse all with life remains not this. A tree works, all things work here, from question mark to exclamation point, and we are not and will never be what we are not right now, potential. We are a living reception of particular circumstances, being infused and having the necessary response to that given the state of the union, so to speak. We work in a way that we do not understand, because understanding is partial, because self-survival is absolutely non-essential to the process. Rest already exists, as does completion. Who is this to surrender to in ourselves? What is there to gain by surrender or lose through defiance? This is what it is to be here, not something we can alleviate ourselves from, but we are willed, empowered to do just that. Try. To imagine ourselves as someone else is not only imagination, it's the case. We are other. Why is all this important? It is really an exercise in self-existence. Everything here is necessarily so. We have only one thing that we cannot do, extinguish ourselves. All else we do is an attempt to gain this power, to unbe what we are, gain power to be the unbeing we are, perceive we are not being. And the beauty is it will all necessarily find its resolve in something that does not need our limitation. Because the limitation is the beautiful dying, powerless parcel that cannot be redeemed, dies and the origin again appears, reassembled, new, meaningful birth. Through personal effort, water is the essence of moisture. Zoolander. So this anonymous has answered my wish even before I voiced it. Apparently the Zoolander is a film that has a great deal of fascination for those who are interested in psyops and mind control in the entertainment industry. Well, that's a digression. That's a very poetic and very evocative, even provocative post there, Zoolander. So thank you for that. This reminds me of something I was listening to just the other night, which was a recording of John DeRuta, the teacher of integrated philosophy from Edmonton, Canada, whom I encountered recently, not in Afghanistan, but elsewhere on the globe, and who's made quite a powerful, profound impression on my psyche and other parts too. And John was talking about how an acorn becomes a tree, not by trying to make itself into anything more than it already is, but simply by being the acorn and allowing itself to extend and to grow into something else, into its potential. Anonymous wants to know, do you know where I left my car keys? Do you know where I left my car keys? They're in the pocket of your blue blazer in your wardrobe. Okay, I suggest we really put ALS to the test. Forget about aliens and viruses and consciousness and leprechauns and whatnot. Let's see if he can answer the greatest Zen koan of all time, as conceived by the late great Bill Hicks. If a hard-on falls in the forest and no one's around, will you go blind? Yes, is the answer. You can see why I'm not a stand-up comedian. If a hard-on falls in the forest and no one's around, will you get blind? I gotta get out of here. I've been here long enough. I've talked more than enough. I've done my best to surprise myself and to discover new possibilities while I'm groping around in the darkness of my all-too-limited intellect. And I hope I've managed to entertain everybody out there for one more week. I have to say, we almost didn't make it this week. I'm really doing my best to keep this going, and I appreciate all your support. I'm very grateful, very heartened that there's been such a strong response in terms of curiosity, and I just hope I've managed to satisfy it. That's it for one more week. This is Stormy Weather. I am Maeolus Cephas, and these are the end times.